his closing argument. He continued to insist, even privately, that the jury would acquit McDonald, even if he, Siegel, were to offer no closing remarks whatsoever. But he had waited more than 9 years to purge himself of all the rage and frustration and anguish he felt on behalf of his most favored, most publicized client, and he had no intention of letting the moment pass. In its closing days, the McDonald trial had come to attract the attention not only of the North Carolina Press and of Newsday on Long Island, but of the Washington Post, the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, the television networks, and the news magazines. People, to Siegel's horror, and to the astonishment and dismay of Jeffrey McDonald, had just printed a feature story on Freddie Kassab and his long quest for justice, in which Kassab was pictured surrounded by law books, looking somber and determined, as if he were perhaps a new appointee to the U.S. Supreme Court, and in which he was quoted as saying, quite injudicially, "If the courts of this country will not administer justice, then I most certainly will." Of the 3 hours and 15 minutes allotted to the defense for its presentation, Siegel had decided that he would speak for the first two, focusing in detail on the inconsistencies in the government's circumstantial case. Then Wade Smith would speak for an hour, in the finest, down-home, country boy style he could muster, about what a wonderful human being Jeffrey McDonald was, and about how much love he and his family had shared, and about how unthinkable it was that a man such as this could have performed deeds such as those with which he was charged. Smith, it must be said, given free rein for an hour, had the ability not only to make each and every member of a Raleigh jury feel that he had known and loved them all since kindergarten, and that the opportunity to speak to them again, even under such unfortunate circumstances as these, was one of the greatest and rarest pleasures of his life, but that even so decent-appearing and kindly a man as Mr. Blackburn, while by no means duplicitous or even manipulative, might be just the teeniest bit less worthy of their absolute faith and trust than he had hitherto seemed. Then Siegel was to return to the lectern once again for 15 minutes of fire and brimstone, venting every bit of his and Jeffrey McDonald's spleen at the way they had been treated throughout the whole sordid affair. He would attack the CID, the FBI, Victor Warheide, Brian Murtaugh, and each and every principal for which they stood. And by the time he was finished, the jury, he was convinced, would be worked up into such a frenzy of anger at this high-handed government mistreatment of a truly decent and noble human being that they would hardly be able to sit through Jim Blackburn's rebuttal. So eager would they be to bring to an end Jeffrey McDonald's long personal nightmare. It did not work out that way. Bernie Siegel carried a wristwatch with him to the lectern, but he was so caught up in the moment that not once, until he was interrupted by the tapping of Franklin Dupree's pencil and a quiet reminder from the bench that "you have 3 hours and 15 minutes, and you have already used 3 hours and 10 minutes of it," did he look at it. Nor did he, apparently, give any thought whatsoever to the passage of time. After 2 hours of Siegel's rambling, sometimes incoherent, often vituperative, and consistently repetitive harangue, Wade Smith had found himself faced with what he considered to be perhaps the most difficult decision of his legal career. Should he leave the defense table, walk to the lectern, and whisper to Siegel that he was running well over the previously arranged time limit, and what's more, he had not yet even begun to cover most of the specific points he had intended to include in his argument? Or should he, because, as had been made clear to him from the day Siegel and his entourage had arrived in Raleigh, he was not, in fact, co-counsel, but only one of Siegel's many assistants, just sit tight and let nature take its course? Jeffrey McDonald, the client, was sitting beside him. If McDonald had so instructed him, Smith indeed would have made that long and embarrassing walk across the courtroom to tell the chief counsel that he was letting his last chance for even a hung jury, much less an acquittal, drown beneath the endless torrent of his words. But McDonald, though squirming uncomfortably in his seat from time to time, like each of the jurors and everyone else in the courtroom, except Siegel, did not issue any such instruction. So Wade Smith sat stiff and watched silently, and in professional horror, as Bernie Siegel, like a runaway train on a steep, icy hill, careened wildly out of control. From the start, at 1 p.m., when Siegel had said bitterly and sarcastically to the jury, "Yes, ladies and gentlemen, there has been a tragedy, but we haven't talked about the real tragedy in this case yet." The real tragedy being, in Siegel's mind, not the murders of Colette and Kimberly and Kristen, but the subsequent destruction of Jeffrey McDonald's life by the American legal system. Siegel's tone and style and content, particularly coming after Blackburn's quiet country elegance, had been not at all what the jury had been expecting or wanting to hear. By 4:10, when Judge Dupree finally and mercifully tapped his pencil, Siegel was swinging wild roundhouse punches at the government, as if he were the prosecuting attorney and it was the Justice Department that was on trial. "Again, the government makes fun," Siegel was shouting. "Why did you come forward, Mr. Posey? If you come forward at all, you get mocked. If you don't come forward because you think they don't need you, you get mocked. You can't win." Even after 3 hours and 10 minutes, Siegel had not yet gotten around to Helena Stokely. He was forced to squeeze her into the 4 minutes which followed the tapping of the pencil, leaving Wade Smith with exactly 60 seconds, rather than the prearranged 60 minutes, to convince the jury that Jeffrey McDonald was such a decent man that he couldn't possibly have killed his wife and children, no matter what the physical evidence appeared to show. A recess was declared by Judge Dupree, during which Smith went over to bargain with Jim Blackburn, to bargain the way two good old boys can, knowing that they will both be living and practicing in the same city long after Bernie Siegel and Jeffrey McDonald and all the out-of-town newspaper reporters have departed. As a professional attorney, and in order to minimize the possibility that Judge Dupree might grant Smith his entire hour, Blackburn, who had 40 minutes remaining to him for rebuttal, agreed to give Wade Smith 10 minutes of that time. There wasn't much Smith could do to repair the damage, but he tried. He picked up his tempo, the way he might have on his banjo, and played it hard and fast and as strong as he could. "Let your insides talk to you for a minute about the case," Smith suggested. "What do you feel? Don't you wonder why, when you think about this? Why did it happen? Don't you wonder, when you were thinking about whether Jeff did it, why would he have done it? Can you think of a reason why?" Now, the prosecution is not under any obligation to furnish a motive. The law does not place that burden on them. Nevertheless, there is natural law. That is law that we feel inside of us, every one of us. And we feel that we can say to the prosecution, "Tell us why. Tell us why this man would have destroyed his family." Think about the photographs that you saw of Jeff with the family, Jeff with the children, Colette with the children playing. It makes no sense. There is no motive. It is unbelievable. It is incredible. Don't you know that Jeffrey McDonald could not have destroyed his children? Don't you know that that raises a reasonable doubt? If you look at the autopsy photographs of those little children and think about what it would take to cause someone to raise a knife and destroy them, to destroy Kristen, not just destroy her, but absolutely mutilate her, just stab her to death, thrust after thrust after thrust. It can't be true. Wade Smith paused. He looked across the courtroom at Jeffrey McDonald, who was sitting perfectly still, eyes downcast, hands folded on the table in front of him. Smith turned back to the jurors. "He needs peace," Wade Smith said softly. "He hasn't had it in a long time. You, as a jury, are immensely powerful, because you can give him peace for the first time in years and years." Months later, one of the jurors was to remark, "I don't know. I don't know. We wanted to believe. We really did. Maybe if Wade Smith had just talked to us a little longer." But he didn't. He couldn't. And Jim Blackburn did. He talked for the final 20 minutes. "You know," he said, "I couldn't help but think during the last 10 minutes, listening to Wade talk about motive, you know, and the unbelievability of it all. And I suppose, in a way, it is unbelievable that a successful person might kill his family, and that a person to whom his children cried, 'Daddy, might raise his hand in anger or rage, or coolness, perhaps, and kill his family. But I can't help thinking back to what I said late this morning. We don't contend that Dr. MacDonald killed his family because Kristen wet the bed. We contend, ladies and gentlemen, that the defendant killed his family because events overtook themselves too fast. Think yourselves for a moment in your own daily lives, if you have been angry at someone, but not really meaning to be, and you have raised your hand, maybe to your own child, but you would never, you know, follow through. You stopped short. You didn't do anything. Suppose when you were tired late in the night or early in the morning and you are worn out and things just aren't going right, that you do raise your hand, and before you can regret it, you have done something that is irretrievable. Everything else, ladies and gentlemen, we say, in that crime scene, flowed from that moment. I don't say to you that the defendant, as I said this morning, has always been a bad person. I don't say to you that for the last 9 years he has been a bad person. But I do say to you that on the early morning of the 17th of February, time stopped in the MacDonald home for a flicker of a second. Something happened which caused tragic events to unfold, and the killing of the children was necessary for self-survival. Mr. Siegel, in his presentation this afternoon, attacked again. He attacked us. He attacked the CID. He attacked Stombaugh. Anybody who has ever been with the government, as I recall, was attacked. He said that our case was like a house built on sand. I suggest to you, ladies and gentlemen, the only sand in this case is that which was perhaps attempted to be thrown into your eyes to keep you from seeing the evidence. You know, Wade Smith talked a minute ago about what you feel inside. Well, that is all right. But what is inside when the defendant takes the stand and does not attempt to explain the unexplainable? When he is asked questions and doesn't give an answer and relies on his counsel to answer for him? We rely, ladies and gentlemen, and ask you to rely on the law of common sense. I will repeat it again this afternoon because it makes a whole lot of sense to me. Don't you know, if he could have, he would have? Mr. Siegel said earlier that the physical evidence doesn't say anything. It doesn't speak. It is only attorneys speaking. I say to you that the physical evidence simply cries out an explanation. The fact that 21 thrusts through the pajama top can make 48 holes that line up with 21 holes in the victim's chest is a singular, significant fact which, I tell you, proves to me beyond a reasonable doubt that Jeffrey MacDonald killed his wife, Colette, and it is a very short leap from that to say that he killed the other two as well. This is a difficult case, not because the evidence is difficult, but because of the people involved. The Kassabs, who have been injured and will be injured for the rest of their lives, regardless of your verdict. Mrs. MacDonald, who has been injured and will be injured the rest of her life, regardless of your verdict. Their friends who will suffer the same fate, and, I guess, the defendant himself. You know, I am sure it is very sad for everybody who knew these people to look at those photographs. I think it is very sad for people who knew these people to look at pictures of the kids playing, of Halloween and Christmas. I wish more than you know that we could have shown you that kind of picture. I wish more than you know we weren't here. I wish more than you know that I did not think the evidence pointed to the defendant. I think the supreme tragedy in this whole thing really is, if our evidence is correct and the defendant did it, which we believe he did, think for a moment of the last minutes of Colette, Kimberly, and Kristen, when they realized that they were going to die, and they realized for the first and the last time who it was that was going to make them die. You wouldn't think it. People have said that he is not that kind of guy. But, ladies and gentlemen, we think that he did. For that, we are sorry. For that, you have an awesome burden and responsibility. You have got to decide, beginning tomorrow, what the evidence is and what your verdict will be. We believe strongly as strongly as we don't want to believe, that he did it, that he is guilty of count one of first-degree murder, of count two of first-degree murder, and count three of first-degree murder. And I ask you to so find. Then Blackburn added a final word. He said, Wade said that you might have the power to give the defendant peace. Well, we suggest, ladies and gentlemen, that regardless of your verdict, whether it is innocent, 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 or guilty, 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 you don't have the power to give this defendant peace. And then, like a man leaving for the last time the bedside of a dying relative, Jim Blackburn slowly turned from the jurors and walked back to his chair. The 7 weeks of trial had exacted a steep price from all concerned, but there were few who could claim to have suffered more than the jurors. The extraordinary responsibility, having to decide whether to set free forever a man who had been under investigation and prosecution for almost a decade, or whether to condemn the same man to spend the remainder of his life in prison, when combined with an unceasing awareness of the particularly horrid and profoundly depressing nature of the offense, had combined to make the summer of 1979, for many, the most traumatic of their lives. And for 7 weeks, through the gore and the shock and the sadness, this knowledge, that one day they would have to decide, had been growing inexorably, almost in the manner of a malignant tumor. The former state policeman who had scored so high on the Duke professor's selection chart, and who was to be chosen by his fellows as the foreman, had for weeks been awakened at night by the sound of a baby crying. There was not, however, any baby in the house. Coming awake in the darkness, he would awaken his wife alongside him to ask her if she heard it too. She never did. Some nights the cry lingered for so long in the air, even after he had come fully awake, that he would get out of bed to investigate, to be sure that there was not a crying baby in another room. There never was. Another juror, a 27-year-old chemist, himself the father of a 2.5-year-old son, had been unable to sleep at all the night before deliberations were to begin. Shortly after 1 a.m., he had tiptoed into the bedroom of his son and had stood for a long time, in silence, staring at the boy's sleeping form. The thought that a father could stab his child through the heart 13 times, he said later, it was almost too difficult to grasp. Almost. As the Raleigh Times said in an editorial the day after the verdict was announced, one of the jury's most difficult obstacles was the instinctive rejection of the idea that a well-educated, apparently civilized man like Dr. McDonald, committed to healing and saving lives rather than to taking them, could have wrought this horror. And, as another of the jurors was to say, everybody was sorry for Dr. McDonald. We didn't want to convict him. There was a party that night, just as there had been a party the night before the first day of trial. Wade Smith came with a guitar. For some time it was feared that Bernie Siegel would not come at all, so despondent was he said to be in the wake of his closing argument. Siegel eventually did arrive, though, and there were beer and wine in moderation, as there had been the first night, and, as on the first night, Wade Smith eventually began to play music and to sing. The room was filled with a spirit of camaraderie, touched with the first traces of nostalgia. Tension regarding the fact that on the morrow the jury would begin to deliberate the fate of Jeffrey McDonald was, for at least a few hours, repressed. The mood seemed almost akin to the last night of summer camp. Soon, whatever the outcome, all these people who had worked so hard and who had shared so much with such intensity would be scattered to various parts of the country, and the chapter of their lives titled McDonald Trial would be closed, though for none of them soon forgotten. Wade Smith, as was his custom, sang traditional favorites, familiar verses with which it was easy to sing along. For the most part, he kept the tempo upbeat. It was toward the end of the evening that he played and sang a more contemporary song, Bob Dylan's I Shall Be Released. To many in the room, the words in this were less familiar, and so there were fewer voices joined to Smith's, though no lack of attention to the lyric by the time he reached the final verse. Standing next to me in this lonely crowd is a man who swears he's not to blame. All day long I hear him shout so loud, crying out that he was framed. Shortly after 4 p.m. the next day, in the suite of defense offices located just down the hallway from the courtroom, Jeffrey McDonald's secretary, who had flown in from California, was on the phone to New York making reservations for McDonald and Candy Kramer to spend the following night at the Warwick Hotel in New York City. She had already made a dinner reservation at a West Side Italian restaurant named La Scala. She had also just sent off a check to Evergreen, Colorado, enrolling McDonald in a wilderness photography workshop that would begin the following week. In the background, there was talk of how to handle the press conference after the acquittal, who should speak first, Siegel or McDonald, and of whether to leave Raleigh by chartered plane immediately, or to wait for a later commercial flight. There was also some discussion about whether McDonald should wear into the courtroom the bulletproof vest, which a Long Beach policeman had flown east with, in case Freddie Kassab, in his moment of supreme and final frustration, might try to administer with a gun the justice he for so long had threatened, and talk also about whether the Queen Mary might be rented for the victory celebration, which would be held upon McDonald's triumphant return to California. Only Wade Smith, who as the trial had progressed had drifted further and further from the core of the McDonald group, remained detached and isolated. For long periods, he sat by himself at the defense table in the suddenly vacant courtroom, his hands clasped before him, staring alternately at the ceiling, the walls, and the floor. It was as if he were a lone worshiper come to an empty church, seeking a few mid-afternoon moments of solace and tranquility. Indeed, he would say later that he had wanted to pass those final hours in silent contemplation, removed from the nervous, noisy, obtrusive optimism and forced gaiety of the defense suite. Wade Smith had tried many cases, and he knew all too well when a big one was about to be lost. McDonald was just beginning to explain to a pert young female assistant the intricacies of Las Vegas craps tables when a court clerk knocked on the door to say that, after only 6.5 hours of deliberation, a verdict had been reached. It took only a few minutes for the entire cast to reassemble. Then Judge Dupree nodded at a bailiff, who opened the door that led to the room in which the jury's deliberation had been conducted. The first juror to walk through the door was the ex-Green Beret. His head was down, and he was crying. He was followed almost immediately by the woman whose son was a member of Kappa Alpha. Her head was down, and she was crying too. Then there was a pause, which seemed long, though maybe it was only 10 or 15 seconds, before the third juror came through the door. But it didn't matter. It would not have mattered if the pause had lasted an hour. Not only Jeffrey McDonald and Bernie Siegel and Wade Smith and McDonald's mother and his secretary and the friends who had flown in from California, but Jim Blackburn and Brian Murtaugh and, in the first row of the right side of the aisle, Freddie and Mildred Kassab, knew what was coming. An ex-Green Beret, who had just voted to acquit another ex-Green Beret of 3 murder charges, does not walk into the courtroom in tears. McDonald was found guilty of second-degree murder in the deaths of Colette and Kimberly, and guilty of murder in the first degree, because the jury believed it to have been a calculated act designed to support his cover story, in the death of his younger daughter, Kristen. McDonald's mother rose from her seat and hurried to a small private alcove just outside. From there, as Judge Dupree prepared to pass sentence upon her son, her keening wail of torment could be heard above the continuing weeping and sobbing of some of the jurors. Not the ex-state policeman, though. Chosen as foreman, he had announced the verdict dry-eyed and in a flat, unemotional voice. Dupree asked the defendant if he had anything to say. McDonald stood. He was wearing his best pinstripe suit. Jeff McDonald, most popular, most likely to succeed, Princeton, med school, the Green Berets, the childhood sweetheart, the two little girls, the farm in Connecticut, the medical career, even the boat and the sports car and the condo and Candy Kramer. All ashes now, as far as he was concerned. Dust and ashes. He said only this, speaking in a loud, though slightly husky voice. Sir, I'm not guilty. I don't think the court heard all the evidence. Judge Dupree sentenced him to 3 life terms in prison, to be served not concurrently, but consecutively. It was the harshest sentence he could administer, the death penalty not being applicable under federal law. Then a U.S. Marshal approached, carrying handcuffs, and Jeffrey McDonald, his face betraying no more emotion than does the surface of a glacier, held his arms out in front of him, as requested. With the handcuffs secured around his wrists, and with Bernie Siegel's immediate motion for bail denied by Franklin T. Dupree, McDonald was led out a rear door, a door through which he had never walked before. He did not look back. If he had, he would have seen Freddie and Mildred Kassab sitting side by side in silence, staring at his departing figure until it disappeared behind the door. Conclusion. If I have walked with vanity. If I have walked with vanity, or if my foot hath hasted to deceit, let me be weighed in an even balance, that God may know mine integrity. Job, verse 31, lines 5 to 6. Chapter 1. I suppose from the start I had suspected that there must be more to the case against McDonald than he had suggested to me on the day that I met him. The Justice Department does not try a man for murder 9.5 years after the crimes just because his father-in-law is mad at him. But certainly, I had arrived in Raleigh bearing the same presumption of innocence which was to be required of the jurors. As the weeks passed, however, the doubts grew. There were the fibers and the bloodstains and the footprint, and of course, the blue pajama top, whose 48 holes matched the 21 in Colette's chest. All this was new to me, and it began to grow rather unsettling as I rode to and from the courtroom with McDonald, and over to Chapel Hill with him on the weekends to browse through bookstores, and to Durham to stroll with him across the campus of Duke University, which he said reminded him so much of Princeton, and as I sat up late with him and his mother, watching Saturday Night Live. It was not the sort of thing one spoke about over the Kappa Alpha dinner table, but he had not been badly hurt in 1970. Those 23 stab wounds that he had referred to on the Dick Cavett show, they had never existed. A bump on the head, 2 slight cuts from a knife, some fingernail scratches, and this was long before I learned that a piece of skin had been found beneath one of Colette's fingernails, and a neat, clean incision, 1 centimeter long, between 2 ribs, just deep enough to cause the partial collapse of 1 lung. This was all that had resulted from his struggle against 3 armed attackers, a struggle during which he was aware, he said, that he was fighting for his own life and for the lives of his wife and children. He's either lying, Franz Joseph Grebner said in 1970, upon learning the limited extent of McDonald's injuries, or else he's the biggest pussy in the world. I had by now seen the pictures of his wife and children. I had seen too many pictures, too many times. I had seen pictures that had been taken when the bodies were found, and I had seen pictures taken at the autopsy, after the blood had been washed off. The crack in Kimberly's skull looked like an aerial view of the Grand Canyon. She had been a 5-year-old child. Kristen had been 2.5. She had been stabbed more than 30 times in her chest and back. I had seen slides showing the holes in her heart. And Colette, pregnant Colette, the childhood sweetheart, her skull fractured, both arms broken as she had raised them in front of her to ward off blows, and her chest penetrated, not once as had been the chest of her husband, but dozens of times by both knife and ice pick, weapons which had been thrust into her up to the hilt. Jeffrey MacDonald had not needed a single stitch to close his wounds. Not even mercurochrome, as Mildred Kassab had said. For years he had been saying that he'd been knocked unconscious and had almost been killed by the attack upon him in his living room, yet not one drop of blood had been found there. At the hospital, his vital signs had been normal, while back at the apartment, the CID photographer had to leave because he was about to get sick to his stomach. There were a lot of nights I did not sleep in Raleigh. It got worse toward the end, particularly after Helena Stokely had testified. It was not so much what she had said or hadn't said. It was Jeffrey MacDonald's absolute lack of reaction to her presence. If his story were true, she was the woman who had participated in the slaughter of his family, and here she was, after 9.5 years, 20 feet from him in the courtroom. Yet he showed no anger, no sorrow, not even curiosity. There was anger at the judge, of course, for not permitting the Stokely witnesses to testify. There was anger at Brian Murtaugh and Paul Stombaugh and Mildred Kassab. But toward the woman who had, he said, destroyed the people he had loved most, and who had reduced his own wife to dust and ashes, he displayed less emotion than he did while watching Gilda Radner perform on Saturday Night Live. 2 days after his conviction, I drove with his mother and Candy Kramer to visit him at the Federal Correctional Institute at Butner, North Carolina, where he was being held temporarily, pending a decision on where he would be sent to serve his term. In the visitor's lounge, which was not dissimilar to a bus station cafeteria, MacDonald, wearing canvas slippers and shapeless gray prison-issue clothing, embraced first his mother, then Candy Kramer, then me. We sat at a small formica-topped table. Candy, who had flown to Raleigh from New York after the verdict, had brought clippings from the previous day's New York Times and New York Daily News. Each paper had printed a front-page story about the conviction, accompanied by a picture of MacDonald in pinstriped suit being led from the courtroom in handcuffs. He read the stories through from start to finish. When he was done, he looked again at the pictures on page one. He had made the Daily News before, but this was the first time that a photograph of him had ever appeared on the front page of the Times. When the visit was over, he gave the clippings to his mother, so she could file them in the scrapbooks which he had been maintaining for 9.5 years. "If we can prove that he did it," Jim Blackburn had said, "then we don't have to prove that he's the kind of guy who could have done it." They had indeed proved that he'd done it. Not to the satisfaction of his mother, or Candy Kramer, or his friends from Southern California, but his mother and Candy Kramer and his friends from Southern California, unlike the jurors, had not attended every session of the trial. For Blackburn and the jurors, it was over, but not for me. Having learned all I had learned during the summer, I now felt I needed to know more. As I left MacDonald there, behind the bars and concrete walls and steel doors of Butner, having just had him tell me that he hoped I was a friend who would stand by him, it was not possible simply to accept the jury's verdict. I had to try to learn more about what kind of man he really was. I flew home the next day, and the day after that a letter arrived. MacDonald had written it even before I'd been to see him. He had written it on the morning of Thursday, August 30th, 1970, the morning after his conviction. 0 hour plus 18. "I've got to write to you so I won't go crazy. I'm standing in my cell only because they don't allow chairs in solitary. I'm trying to fathom, trying to figure out what the fuck happened. Those words from the foreman's mouth crashed into my brain, and I can't think straight. Just as I felt, finally, justice and maybe some peace down the road, he said, 'Guilty of second-degree murder.' The room was spinning, and I couldn't hear the rest. I remember the tears on many jurors' faces, and I remember the look of 'Please forgive me,' on the faces of the black juror and the lady who cried so much. But I really can't remember the jury polling, except how forceful the guy with the pinched face in the front row, three in from the right, I think, said, guilty, three times. He really believed it. I can't understand how it happened. 12 normal people heard a good portion of the evidence, not all, of course, and bought the government line of bullshit. Was it just because the government said so? Were our jury selection people wrong? I guess so. They were so right-wing, middle class, they couldn't believe the government would falsify evidence, or fake it, or redo it, or build an imaginary web of circumstances based on vicious Mildred Kassab now remembering, something was wrong in that house. I am now a convict, convicted of murder of my family. Colette and Kimmy and Christy had come back so strong to me over the past 3 months, it was like 1970. The 9 years had been swept away, and I knew it would be a slow, painful recovery for the next 1 to 2 years when the not guilty verdict came down. Now, I just don't know. My brain has never felt like this. In 1970, I was so numb with grief, I just plodded through the motions. The night of April 6th, 1970, was brutal, but I don't remember the pain like this. The fucking walls are closing in. Every once in a while, a warden or a shrink comes around and asks how I am. Someone in my voice answers, okay, just taking it one day at a time. What I mean is that I'm going crazy. I'm trying to hold on 1 second at a time. I wish the guards here were brutal. You could focus on some uniformed asshole and out-tough him, even if that meant not falling for the hint of a threat or an insult. Here the fucking guards are all correctional officers, who went to at least 2 years of college and discuss things like, the first 24 hours are the worst, and keep a low profile. Do you know those lectures? Why the fuck am I in solitary? The warden says, for my benefit, so inmates won't test the new fast gun from the West. I don't really want to talk to inmates, but a little more light in the cell, and a window bigger than 8 inches by 8 inches looking at another solitary cell across the hall would help. If I don't run soon, I'll go nuts. Last night was the longest ever. The guard looked in my window with a flashlight every 15 minutes for 12 hours. Suicide watch. The few times I fell asleep, a flashlight would immediately penetrate my eyeballs. I can't figure out what the fuck I'm supposed to kill myself with. They only allow plastic spoons with the meal. The guard sits right outside my cell and checks every 15 minutes. I guess I'm supposed to have smuggled something in, despite the 3 strip searches, the 6 gates we went through, and my room, which is bare except for a welded, one-piece bed, a single-piece toilet with sink above it, and a stand bolted to the floor, for food and toiletries. I want to see Bernie, because I love him, and he is probably hurting beyond belief, and wants to know he is not to blame. I want to see my mom, because no matter how I look, by seeing me she will be better, and I probably will be too. I would also love to see my best friends, including, I hope, you. But in all honesty, I'm crying too much today, and do cry whenever I think of my close friends. I feel dirty and soiled by the decision, and can't tell you why, and am ashamed. I somehow don't feel that way with Bernie and Mom, but think today it would be difficult to look at you or shake your hand. I know I'll cry, and want to hug you, and yet the verdict stands there screaming, you are guilty of the murder of your family. And I don't know what to say to you, except it is not true, and I hope you know that, and feel it, and that you are my friend. Jeffrey McDonald remained in solitary confinement at Butner for 6 days. He wrote me a letter every day, sometimes more than one a day. I knew my mom was strong, but she surprises even me. What an incredible person to pull it all together and be so optimistic so soon after the crushing defeat. Someday when this is over, I hope I can return just part of her love and caring. It's strange how 48 hours can alter your perspective so much. If you had asked me Wednesday a.m., would I accept a victory through the Court of Appeals, I would have laughed at you. Now I am pleading for my lawyers to argue the best case ever in front of Fourth Circuit in order that I may win a more hollow victory than anyone ever previously guessed I would accept. Like Lenny Bruce said, when it's your asshole they are pouring hot lead into, then tell them you'll withhold secrets from the enemy, and not before. Of course, I'll accept a Fourth Circuit victory. It will be more difficult to face my friends than it would have been with a victory last Wednesday at 4:45 p.m., but I'll do it. I hope my friends accept it, and the rest of the world that thinks I got off on a technicality will have to wait for your book. If they won't read your book, fuck them. Then they are worse than the jury. I can't get my mind off the tear-stained faces. Why couldn't they have had the courage to vote the way I'm sure the majority felt in their gut? Proof of guilt was not beyond a reasonable doubt. Have you ever been strip-searched? You strip naked, and they look in your ears, armpits, mouth. The guard says, "Lift it up," and you lift first your penis, then your scrotum. You then turn around, bend over, and spread your cheeks. You then lift up each foot so the guard can see the bottoms of your feet. After they search your clothes, shoes, socks, and underwear, you put it all back on. It's always slightly sweaty, because either you're on the way to a visit and are anticipating the pleasure/pain of it, or you are coming from a visit and are suffering from the new-each-time separation from the real world. I can now think of Colette and Kim and Chris and not go crazy. And I can separate Colette from Bobby. And I can even squeeze Candy in there and not confuse it all. But 12 tear-stained faces keep intruding. The foreman's voice keeps me awake. Couldn't the son of a bitch have found reasonable doubt? In the first moments that followed the jury's announcement of its verdict, Franklin T. Dupree, Jr. had denied Bernie Siegel's plea that McDonald be permitted to remain free on bail pending appeal. The judge had said, however, that he would consider a written motion to that effect. Siegel filed such a motion on September 4th. The next day, with Dupree not yet having ruled on the request, the process of transferring McDonald from Butner to the Federal Correctional Institution at Terminal Island, California, was begun. Despite the ominous sound of its name, Terminal Island was, under the circumstances, as desirable a destination as McDonald could possibly have hoped for. A low-security institution on the outskirts of Long Beach, just 15 minutes from St. Mary's Hospital and less than half an hour from his Huntington Beach condominium, Terminal Island did not, as a rule, house individuals convicted of homicide. In fact, of the more than 500 inmates, McDonald would be the only one serving a life sentence. It was not then Terminal Island itself that was objectionable from Jeffrey McDonald's point of view. It was the means by which he would get there. Early on the morning of September 5th, McDonald was placed aboard a Bureau of Prisons bus to begin the long journey west. Unlike Greyhound or Trailways, the federal prison transport system did not offer express service to the coast. A prisoner would ride the bus to wherever its next stop happened to be. There he would be held for hours, days, or weeks until the next leg of his journey could be scheduled. McDonald's first stop was the federal penitentiary at Atlanta. From there he wrote to me on Thursday, September 6th, expressing, among other sentiments, his displeasure at his attorney's decision to permit his transfer while the bail question was still under consideration by Judge Dupree. Fucking lawyers are a pain in the ass. They charge you coming and going, and for all their little expenses, lose goddamn cases when they shouldn't be lost, promise you the world all the while, and don't know shit about what they are doing. They operate like mail-order physicians. The whole profession sucks. Every prisoner along the way fell over laughing when they heard I could have stayed at Butner until the bail was settled. Everyone in the system knows the single worst thing about the prison system is the method used for cross-country transfer. Up at 4 a.m., into bus at 5:30 a.m., chained and manacled, ankles, waist, and wrists, and drive to next prison. It may take 4 hours or 14. No one cares. You stay in chains the whole time, ankles, wrists, and waist. So if the bus overturns, you can burn to death instead of escaping. The bus is caged, barred, partitioned, and has three hacks, guards. You can't have anything. No shoelaces, No contact lenses, no books, magazines. If you want to pee, you struggle down the alley in chains, spend 10 minutes getting your fly open, and pee down a big hole in the back of the bus. Holding tank, but no chemicals, of course. The coffee runs out at noon, so from noon until 9:45 p.m., you get nothing. The sandwiches are bread and one, I mean one, slice of corned beef, 1.5 inches wide, or bologna. If the air conditioner breaks, tough. No windows to open. Each night you spend 2 hours getting photographed and fingerprinted at some federal hovel, and then you get put in solitary. No possessions at all. No books, letters, watch, contacts, deodorant. Every guard and prisoner at Atlanta knew I was coming. The prisoners were okay. Every guard said, "Keep your fucking back to the wall. Don't let anyone next to you. Some crazy motherfucker will kill you here for a headline." And on and on. By the time you get to solitary, you're begging for a single cell. And then you find out some inmates, walk-arounds, have keys to the cells and walk in every once in a while to check things out. You can't beat the son of a bitch to pulp for scaring the shit out of you because you don't want Thorazine and a straitjacket. It's clear that you're being measured, and if you're cool and handle yourself okay, you suddenly get a bar of soap or a cup of real ice water through the foot slot. Or the dude across the hall tells you which hack to watch out for. Or someone says, "He's the Green Beret who got screwed. Leave him alone." I'm sitting in the VIP suite in solitary. Some porno king just vacated it. I'm in a long line of celebrities to get this cell. I don't know what to make out of this insanity. Tomorrow at 4 a.m. I'll get awakened. I'm going to Texarkana jail by bus. I was lucky, they said. Usually you have to wait at least a week for the Texarkana bus. The inmates say it takes up to 3 months to cross the country unless you're top priority celebrity status. Can you dig it? A celebrity because I got railroaded by a North Carolina judge and jury for something I didn't do 9.5 years ago. The next day, Judge Dupree reaffirmed his denial of bail, stating, "While it is true that this defendant is a well-established professional man and has never heretofore failed to meet all court appearances, the situation with which he is now confronted is far different from that which has heretofore obtained. As a highly skilled physician, the defendant presumably would have no difficulty in finding employment in any of the many countries of the world which do not have extradition treaties with the United States, and the temptation to seek refuge in another country would certainly be great indeed." Not yet informed of Dupree's decision regarding bail, McDonald wrote to me from Texarkana. "I'm going nuts waiting to hear about bail. No news in Atlanta, and now nothing here for 2 days. You'd think that lawyers that spent $200,000 losing a case could spend $5 on a telegram to Texarkana with some news. If I ever get out of jail, I hope to fuck one of them gets shot or in a car accident and comes to my emergency room. We'll discuss fees first, then I'll disappear for a while and let them watch a clock on the wall for a while. Then I'll slowly institute treatment, stopping every now and then to wait for more money. Gradually, they'll realize that this could take years. Every time they get uptight, I'll give them the option offered me. Continued flow of money for unknown treatments that are not necessary. Or I can sign off the case, and they are free to find another doctor. I'd love it." McDonald remained in Texarkana for another 10 days. Then he was bused to El Reno, Oklahoma, and then to El Paso, Texas, from where he was finally flown to the Long Beach Airport, arriving on September 27th in chains. He wrote to me 2 days later from Terminal Island, terming it reasonable, decent food, exercise, no harassment from guards, and only subliminal violence. It's still prison, but bearable. He then wrote, "It is very strange to sit on my bunk in prison, for Christ's sake, and see Long Beach Harbor. The ships, the sailboats, the breakwater, downtown Long Beach and the seagulls and pelicans. I see it all through A, bars, B, wire fence, C, barbed wire with razor-type barbs. I am so near to my home, my friends, my work, but in truth, light years away. He continued, I'm trying to get over some mild anterior shin splints from running on concrete in prison sneakers. My clothing box has arrived from home, and I now have my Etonics. I'm also lifting weights. He then mentioned, saying he would supply more detail later, notoriety upon arrival, press attempts to see me, everyone aware of my arrival, and continued, support continues to pour in and has really been phenomenal. I still am getting letters from North Carolina citizens who apparently were/are outraged by the judge and jury's actions. People here in Long Beach have been just super. The job is still mine at the hospital. The staff is behind me, and hundreds of people from all over are offering money, time, letters, etc., etc. It makes me feel good. On October 5, 1979, Bernie Siegel asked the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals in Richmond to overrule Judge Dupree's denial of bail. On October 12, McDonald's 36th birthday, friends and former colleagues from St. Mary's rented an airplane to fly over the prison, trailing a sign that said, Happy Birthday, Rock, Rock being the nickname he had acquired in the emergency room in tribute to his coolness and steadiness under pressure. Oral argument on his motion for bail took place before a 3-judge panel of the Fourth Circuit Court on November 6th. 10 days later, the appeals court upheld Judge Dupree's denial. The following week, I flew to California. Chapter 2. In all the orthodox psychoses, Hervey Cleckley has written in The Mask of Sanity, there is a more or less obvious alteration of reasoning process or of some other demonstrable personality feature. In the psychopath, this is not seen. The observer is confronted with a convincing mask of sanity. All the outward features of this mask are intact. It cannot be displaced or penetrated. Examination reveals not merely an ordinary two-dimensional mask, but what seems to be a solid and substantial structural image of the sane and rational personality. The observer finds verbal and facial expressions, tones of voice, and all the other signs we have come to regard as implying conviction and emotion and the normal experiencing of life as we know it ourselves and as we assume it to be in others. Only very slowly and by a complex estimation or judgment based on multitudinous small impressions does the conviction come upon us that, despite these intact rational processes, these normal emotional affirmations, and their consistent application in all directions, we are dealing here not with a complete man at all, but with something that suggests a subtly constructed reflex machine which can mimic the human personality perfectly. So perfect is this reproduction of a whole and normal man that no one who examines him in a clinical setting can point out in scientific or objective terms why or how he is not real. And yet we eventually come to know, or feel we know, that reality, in the sense of full, healthy experiencing of life, is not here. I rented a car at the Los Angeles airport and drove to Long Beach. On that hot and cloudless Saturday morning in June, when I had driven down this same San Diego freeway en route to my first meeting with Jeffrey McDonald, I had been listening to an FM music station. Just as I had finally found his condominium and had located a parking space, a song ended. It was a song I had never heard before. The disc jockey, a woman, said, I don't know why I decided to play that. It hadn't been programmed. Something just came over me and made me do it. As I was turning off the ignition, she gave the name of the song. It was Psycho Killer, Qu'est-ce que c'est? Those were the last words I had heard before meeting Jeffrey McDonald for the first time. All summer long, I had been telling myself it was only a coincidence, nothing more. Now, in November, heading toward Long Beach on another warm and sunny afternoon, I turned on the radio. The first song I heard was from the new Eagles album, which had just been released. The song was called Heartache Tonight, and it began, Somebody's gonna hurt someone before the night is through. Somebody's gonna come undone. There's nothing we can do. I drove to St. Mary's Hospital and parked the car. I went inside and saw Jeffrey McDonald's secretary. She gave me the keys to his condominium. She said he was holding up well. I would be living in the condominium during my stay. It was conveniently situated, less than half an hour's drive from Terminal Island, and it would provide me with easy access to the thousands of pages of material related to the case which Jeffrey McDonald had accumulated over the years and which he'd agreed to make available to me in order that I might be better able to write my book. Among those personality disorders upon which considerable psychiatric attention has been focused in the past decade is a condition known as pathological narcissism. In his 1978 book, The Culture of Narcissism, Christopher Lash has identified some of the character traits associated with this disorder as being pseudo-self-insight, calculating seductiveness, nervous, self-deprecatory humor, a dependence on the vicarious warmth provided by others combined with a fear of dependence, a sense of inner emptiness, and boundless, repressed rage. Indeed, Lash writes, the personality of the pathological narcissist consists largely of defenses against this rage. Unable to acknowledge his own aggression, to experience guilt, or to mourn for lost love objects because of the intensity of his rage, the pathological narcissist, while sexually promiscuous rather than repressed, and often pansexual as well, seeks to avoid close involvements which might release intense feelings of rage. Instead, he attempts to compensate himself for his experience of rage and envy with fantasies of wealth, beauty, and omnipotence. Jeffrey McDonald's condominium was quite comfortable once I got used to all the mirrors. In the mornings, I would sit on the deck for a while, enjoying the sun. The recovery room bobbed gently at anchor, only a few feet away. McDonald's friends were continuing the payments on the boat and on the Citroen Maserati and on the condominium itself, so everything would be waiting for him when he returned. They all felt, because he told them repeatedly that it was certain, that this would be only a matter of months. The Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals, despite its denial of bail, was sure either to dismiss the charges entirely on the same speedy trial grounds it had invoked in 1975, or at the very least, to order a new trial. So contaminated had the first one been by the malice and bias of Judge Dupree. I would spend hours each day with McDonald's files, going box by box, drawer by drawer, folder by folder, through every piece of paper I could find. He had, of course, the complete transcript of the Article 32 hearing, and in addition, he had copies of the grand jury testimony of each of his family members, as well as of all those witnesses who were later called by the government to testify at trial. I would read slowly through these volumes, taking notes, becoming aware for the first time of an enormous amount of detail that had not been presented at trial. I found, for example, in the notes prepared at the request of his military attorney shortly after his interview with the CID on April 6, 1970, that McDonald had written that on Monday, February 16th, in addition to everything else he had done, he had called a Major Sampson. He is a pediatrician at Womack. We discussed moonlighting at Lumberton Hospital, and I asked to be put on the staff. He said I could begin working there shortly. Thus, in addition to having worked every night of January at Cape Fear Valley Hospital in Fayetteville, and having begun to work weekend shifts at Hamlet Hospital, 60 miles away, McDonald had, on the last afternoon before the murders, sought yet a third moonlighting job. This seemed hardly consistent with his assertion that the months at Fort Bragg had been a reattachment of our entire family because we were having the time and I wasn't tired and I didn't have to rush off to work. In the same notes, he also had written, "One more thing. I think I got a call from the coach of the Fort Bragg boxing team. He had mentioned to me they needed a doctor to accompany the team for 30 days on a trip to Russia. I jumped at the chance and offered myself. He called me on Monday, I think, to tell me the Department of the Army was trying to get me on orders for the trip, and I would probably hear from him in the next several days. both Colette and I were very happy about this. This was consistent, perhaps, with his 1970 diary entry regarding the boxing trip, but hardly